having a positive response to increasing saturation levels. Makes a lot of sense. Surprising difference about crustaceans, or at least seems to be that calcification decreases with increasing saturation levels, which is rather surprising. And I think the mechanism has yet to be worked out. But you see here that lobsters are not only tolerant to rather corrosive waters, but they become increase their calcification rates. And so these are the treatments. It's important to note that they were done. This was done at 25 degrees Celsius, which is well above the comfort zone for lobsters. So it would be interesting to do this at more ambient levels, typical of the Gulf of Maine. Another study by of European lobster. This one focused on larval effects. I'll just bring your attention quickly to the point that there are three larval stages, and then there's a metamorphosis to the post-larval stage that looks a lot like a lobster. Take-home message here is that calcification levels were pretty similar among the three larval stages, but dropped significantly at the fourth stage. This is the stage that where you're starting to get exoskeleton development. So there seems to be a cost here. But there was no effect on survival, development time, or growth for Homarus gammarus. Similar study has not been done for the American lobster that's of any quality that I know of. And finally, I wanted to just bring your attention to this work on king crab and tanner crab, because it's yet another that looks at survivability and growth. And in this case, there was definitely a negative effect of acidification on growth. On survival here and on growth under these rather extreme conditions, very very corrosive conditions, and in the highest PCO2 treatment. And remember, this is very cold water, 4 to 8 degrees for these species. Final major slide here is just, you know, this brings your attention to the mechanisms operating in calcification at the tissue level in the exoskeleton. So we're looking at the this is a study done by Kunkel et al. He's done some really fine structure analyses of the American lobster exoskeleton, and basically to whip through these different layers, we've got this. First of all, you've got the blood pH at about on the acid side, whereas your ambient seawater pH is going to be up around 7.8, 8.2. Bottom water is probably closer to the 7.8 level. But then you have this, as you move down through the exoskeleton, you enter this unstirred layer that's essentially basic because you're accumulating hydroxyl ions out here and is thought to be somewhat antibiotic and thus a barrier to bacterial infection. Then you work your way through the first physical barrier, the epicuticle, which regulates dissolution of the calcite layer, which is just below it in the exocuticle. And then you get further down into what are referred to as trabeculae. It's mainly a matrix of apatite that's embedded in an amorphous calcium carbonate. And more of this amorphous carbonate, calcium carbonate, available to the exterior, and may be a path for invasion of disease. But let me just wrap up with this laundry list of quote, I could not have said it better myself. Dave Cousins, president of the Maine Lobstermen's Association, Bangor Daily News, he said it well. We don't really know the effects of ocean acidification on lobsters, but we do know the effects on shellfish and clams, and it's not positive. As long as the industrial nations of the world use fossil fuel, it's going to get worse. He said it well. Here's the challenges to the fishery, and this is my last slide. The lobster range is clearly shifting northward. We're going to be seeing increasing losses in southern New England, as far as I can tell, and a deepening of the population down there to offshore, offshore deeper waters. We have a worrisome expanding prevalence of shell disease, and the industry is contending with that. They're also dealing with the increasing cost of fishing and the dropping value of the product, and they're hard at work mitigating that, as good businessmen they are. These extreme climate events have taken the industry by surprise, and so that brings me to the scientific challenges ahead. We've got to reconcile some of these stage and species-specific differences in OA effects, those opposite effects of PCO2 on calcification in different organisms is intriguing, and the mechanisms need to be understood. We've got to also put acidification effects in perspective relative to other physical and biotic drivers of recruitment and lobster abundance, and that's why I felt it important to do that up perspective. understanding how shell disease is linked to temperature and OA effects, if at all, is going to involve a better understanding of the skeleton mineralogy and physiology behind shell deposition. And we've got to understand the other processes that ocean acidification and temperature affect, including gene expression, protein function, oxygen binding, immunology, hormonal controls, and so on. We haven't seen any long-term studies on growth or survival yet, lifelong growth studies, that is. These have mostly been short-term studies, and so we need to expand our view there. And nobody's done any work on the population level, looking at microevolutionary responses with OA and temperature being an important selective agents and operating at different levels, intensities regionally. Last two things, what are the implications for trophic interactions? If calcification is shells are softening, does that make lobsters more prone to predators? Predicting these extreme events, we're doing a fair job of predicting the long-term trends and the means, but these extreme events seem to be the main factors that are affecting distributions in the northward shift. So I'll stop there. I know I ran a little bit long there, but I think I captured it. Thank you, folks.
Greg, thank you very much for that. We have got some questions here, so I'm going to read them out, and hopefully you can give us some answers.
All right.
So this is from Peg Parker. Doesn't the historic landings record also show that lobster landings were high in the past at the same time groundfish landings were higher?
Well, they weren't nearly as high as they are now. More to the point, historically, before ground fish harvesting really started in earnest, even in pre-colonial days, yes, we have reports of large, conspicuous lobsters that the colonists saw, but they were not being harvested intensively, and my sense is that they were lading as large and abundant lobsters up in the less vulnerable size classes over many, many decades of recruitment unhindered by harvesting. So it was possible to achieve large abundance once lobsters escaped that gauntlet of predators.
Thank you, Rick. I've got a few questions here from Joe Salisbury. For the settlement index, how is the density defined?
It's actually a direct estimate of numbers of lobsters per square meter within a well-defined cobble boulder habitat. We use a standardized half square meter quadrat. Divers use the suction sampler device to vacuum everything up inside that quadrat, and we return to fixed sites. And there's some 100 sites in the overall survey from Rhode Island into Atlantic Canada.
Thank you. Next one from Joe is, it's interesting that the pH is so often higher at the bottom at several locations. Is it benthic productivity?
Well, Joe, you're probably more the expert than I am at this one, but my sense has been that it's likely a result of benthic respiration, and the CO2 that's produced as a result of that.
Thank you, Rick. And Joe also says that he asked me to tell you that he stole the OA and Shell slide from Andrew Barton.
Okay, thank you.
So I think that's kind of in trying to disclose everything.
Yeah.
Libby Jewett asks, is there any work on effects of ocean acidification on lobster happening anywhere right now, or any proposals pending with NSF?
Well, as a matter of fact, first of all, I know that Tim Bowden at the University of Maine has had a student working on the effect on American lobster larvae. I haven't seen recent reports from him, so I don't know where that work stands. I have teamed up myself with David Fields at the Bigelow Laboratory. David is a zooplankton ecologist, works with copepods, has NSF support for OA effects on copepods. And I've teamed up with him and Spencer Greenwood, who's a functional genomics expert, does qPCR with the American lobsters, so it has especially strong expertise with the American lobster genome and developmental shifts in gene regulation. So the three of us have teamed up to submit to NSF some iOS program for looking at the interaction of OA and temperature on gene expression and phenotypic expression in lobster larvae. And that's a pre-proposal right now.
Thank you, Rick. question here from Esperanza. Knowing the importance of the fishery and the vulnerabilities to ocean acidification in the New England region, is there any discussion or plans amongst lobster researchers about conducting the much needed research on OA for lobsters? So that may be partly answered before, but anything else to add?
Well, yeah, I guess I partly answered that question about the NSF proposal we've submitted. Well, I think Libby and Dwight know that I've been making inquiries about how we might out about